Our next case for argument is 24-1831, IronSource versus Digital Turbine. Mr. Ackerman, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Ackerman, and I represent the appellant in this case, IronSource, in its appeal from the PTAB, challenging the Board's erroneous findings that the substitute claims presented by Digital Turbine during a post-grant review are both patent-eligible and patentable. The appeal presents three distinct and independent grounds why we believe the Board incorrectly determined that the substitute claims are entitled to issue.
But the first question is standing.
The first question is standing, Your Honor.
You're standing there, but why does your client have standing to appeal here? You haven't been accused of infringement.
We have not been accused of infringement, and this Court has made clear that in the procedural posture of a case coming from the PTAB, an actual allegation of infringement is not necessary. I think that this Court's decision in General Electric versus Raytheon Technologies is very informative of this case. It clearly points out that in that context, we accept the declarant's statements of injury in fact as true, and we also emphasize that under the relaxed standing of, or the relaxed standards of standing from Spokio, the real emphasis in this procedural context is whether there's an injury in fact to the person who's appealing. The London Declaration that was submitted with our opening brief makes
it appears to me that much of your case just stands on speculation on things that could happen. Show me something that's really concrete, a concrete injury.
Yeah, the concrete injury, Your Honor, is that our client has a product that they have not only conceived, but they have developed a fully functional product that is now taken off the market because of the risk of infringement liability. Before they took it off the market, they hobbled the product a bit by removing features because of the patents in suit and offered contractual indemnity to customers, creating more financial hardship. So the injury, in fact, is very clear. A product that took expensive time and energy to develop is not being sold or marketed because there is a threat in the marketplace of an infringement suit.
Okay, the last part seems critical, right? There has to be a threat in the marketplace of an infringement suit, or at least a reasonable apprehension thereof somehow.
And again, I would say that the reasonable apprehension is actually reflective more of the pre-General Electric type of framing of the issue. We do have a reasonable apprehension of suit here, even though the London Declaration has that coming through communications with our customer. Our customer was informed by Digital Turbine that their patents would prevent this product from being on the market.
Not their patents, plural.
Correct.
But a particular patent whose claims were invalidated and gone.
Correct.
So how does that create a threat for a different patent? I mean, certainly you would agree with me that if I threatened your client about a patent or bicycle, and later on I acquire a different patent, a different set of claims, mm-hmm. that may have some meaningful differences between the claims I asserted against you or threatened you with, and those original claims were all invalidated, there has to be established connection. Because the thing that your customer was told related to a patent that was invalidated. So they can't, there's no question they can't be threatening you with that, right? Your client cannot possibly feel threatened to have to take things off the market now in light of the invalid patent, correct?
Well, yes, but I respectfully disagree because of the procedural posture of the substitute claims that are before this panel. The 951 patent that was the source of the original threat is now invalid. The claims of the 256 patent that the board found to be invalid because of collateral estoppel were broader than the 951 patent. Almost the same, but they broadened a couple of claim limitations. No difference in the perceived threat from this broader claim. And now we have the substitute claims which have two minor changes in language, and the London Declaration...
But here's the problem. You haven't demonstrated at all how the now-substituted narrower claims would... How is it why your client would feel under apprehension of suit? You haven't done anything to tease out those new claim limitations and explain how they may or may not read on the product your client seeks to be able to sell. And that's a problem for me.
Your Honor, in the London Declaration in paragraphs 29 and 30, he does generally refer to the substitute claims.
Where is the London Declaration?
That's specifically appendix 4389 to 4390, the paragraphs 29 and 30 that were cited. And this Court has said that the party under threat of infringement need not concede infringement in order to establish standing. And again, the GE case...
So what is it he said on paragraph 29, I'm there right now, that... specifically connected the dots for me between this completely different claim with two new narrowing limitations and, you know, how did he say, for example, this new claim is insubstantially different, those two limitations don't affect the product? What did he say that would do something to make me feel more comfortable that you're not in here trying to appeal a claim that you really aren't under any real perceived threat of infringing?
Yeah, in 29, Mr. London points out that the substitute claims of the 256 patent found to be patentable present a direct and continuing impediment to IronSource's plans to provide potential and existing customers with the oral product. And then they continue that those substitute claims, IronSource continues to suffer injuries. And if we look at the nature of the claim amendments, it is a minor change in an eligibility check. And again, GE is informative. In the GE case, this court found that the affidavit only obliquely referenced the specific limitations, but did still identify a current threat that was sufficient. And in fact, in the GE case, there was zero threat from Raytheon.
Counsel, even if you have standing, why aren't you collaterally estopped? The Patent Office found you were collaterally estopped.
On the one issue on collateral estoppel that the Board discussed, that was on the 101 issue, Your Honor, Digital Turbine actually conceded that the way the Board addressed its decision, it could not be and did not raise collateral estoppel for the substitute claims that were in play because, according to Digital Turbine, those claims are patently distinct from the claims that were addressed in the 951 decision. Even if they didn't concede that, Your Honor, the procedural posture on the 101 issue would make it so collateral estoppel should not attach against our position on 101 claims. In the 951 proceeding, all claims were invalidated on prior art. We had no basis to appeal the 101 decision. We would have had to wait for our reply brief. It was not an issue that could be cross-appealed. And when IronSource voluntarily withdrew their appeal, they deprived us the opportunity to appeal the Board's decision. But again, even Digital Turbine has conceded that this is not an estoppel issue on 101. Now, going to the merits, our papers address them in great detail, and I'm not sure I can do justice to them in the 6 minutes that I have to argue. But if we look at the written description argument, there are two limitations, but I want to focus on what's called the query limitation of the papers. In the revised motion to amend, Digital Turbine edited the language, querying an address repository for a network address of an installation file for said first software application and receiving the network address in response to the query. The plain language of this claim limitation has two specific requirements. One, you're going to make a query that is specifically for a network address of an installation file for the said software application. And in response to that query, you're going to receive the network address. The framing of this limitation by Digital Turbine was very specific, and it was intended to address its perceived vision of white space in the prior art. They argued that PASHA does not disclose the installation client querying an address repository for a network address of an installation file, the exact claim language, for a software application. They further argue that even if they were to receive a query, the query would still not be for a network address, it would be for a download page. They found specific patentable weight to the language for a network address of an installation file. The problem is that they found this in the silence of their own disclosure. And silence is not possession of an invention. Counsel for DT was in possession of an argument to try to find patentability, but that is not possession of an invention. This is very factually analogous to the Moles case, where claim language was added to a reflow solder process. And at the time in the art, a person of skill in the art might have divined that that would have been a way of attaching. But the silence in the disclosure was determinative. Just because something is obvious doesn't mean that there is possession of an invention. And here, where you have an applicant adding specific claim limitations, arguing that they're not in the prior art, and those very same limitations, there's only silence on a broad, broad way that something could be accomplished, that's not possession of a specific claim limitation that is found in the remote, in the substitute claims. I would like to address the 101 issue. I'm skipping around on substantive issues. If there's questions, please ask. But substantively, the board erred in finding that these claims were indeed directed to patent-eligible subject matter. Starting with step one of Alice, we had argued that the claims are directed to an abstract concept of downloading in the background while maintaining the user experience in the foreground. The board expressly found that the claims are directed to downloading and installing an application in the background instead of directing the user to an app store, thereby maintaining user experience with the foreground application. Despite being somewhat critical of our framing of the abstract concept as being too general, they essentially adopted our language, but then went on to say that downloading in the background in this manner is not an abstract concept. We respectfully disagree with the board's findings. This is exactly a concept that was known for years. You download in the background while you can do something else in the foreground. There is nothing new in the computer arts about it. It was set forth in the record that Windows operating systems and others have done this for an eternity. And despite finding that the claims were not directed to an abstract concept, the board continued them. They alleged in step two...
Counsel, you're making the decision not to save any time for rebuttal. If that's what you want to do, you should go for it. But seems like a risky move.
Yes, I will save my 2 minutes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Gregorian, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Todd Gregorian for the appellee. So this case presents a classic request for advisory opinion. IronSource is a competitor in the field and would like the Court to advise it on the new substitute claims before it decides whether to engage in any activity that implicates them, whether that's restarting an old product, beginning a new product. They have shown no controversy. They've shown no contact between the parties concerning these claims or concerning the invalidated claims. For Digital Turbine's conduct, we have only a statement that is alleged to have made from an unidentified person 5 years ago at Digital Turbine.
So dropping a product isn't sufficient. If they had continued with it, there would have been a threat. But if they drop the product, it's gone. So, and therefore, they're not standing. Is that basically it?
I wouldn't phrase it that way, because I think the key thing that is missing there is no connection in this record between their prior product and either the predecessor claims that were invalidated or the new substitute claims. And that is a hard and fast requirement in this Court's recent decisions in appeals from PGRs and IPRs, that there needs to be some showing of a concrete plan to engage in activity that risks infringement or infringement suit. And in Platinum Optics and in Insight and other decisions as well, the court has said, like, that needs to, the dispute needs to be about the claims that this court is going to adjudicate. Now, here we are missing that, because the only thing that Mr. London's declaration says about the predecessor product is that it is a sandboxed environment. There's four paragraphs in that, or four bullet points in that declaration, and it says, click to install as it existed 5 years ago was an ability to avoid an app store where you click on the advertising link in App 1 and you will have a download from ironSource's sandbox servers. So there is not even in that description any admission that there's a background install going on. But put all of that aside, there's absolutely nothing in this declaration that talks about the eligibility check or the querying limitation, which are significant narrowing limitations that give these substitute claims a specific implementation. All that let me circle back there, though, and say there is a further point that Your Honor hit on, which is they did select the product. And the question for this court now is, what is the dispute? And there is no dispute if the product has been stopped and there is no activity, nor a concrete plan for activity. And let me just put to the court a hypothetical here, and that is what they could have done in that declaration. They had a free shot after the proceedings below to do whatever they wanted. Not to say whatever they wanted, of course, but to do whatever they wanted. They could have convened a meeting at ironSource and approved a product plan and allocated an initial investment and told you all about that and told you that while not admitting infringement, there are aspects of that planned product that we have taken concrete steps towards that would implicate the claims in such a way that Digital Turbine might, notwithstanding the fact we've never said anything to them before, assert infringement. They did none of that. All they did was say they have a desire, that's the specific language from the declaration. They have a desire to introduce some sort of unspecified product in the future. And that is,
I don't think that's a fair characterization at all. They said they want to reintroduce the C2I functionality. That's what the declaration expressly says. We want to reintroduce the C2I functionality, and these new claims are preventing us from doing that. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like you've got a pretty good case, but this feels, your current statements feel like a pretty big overreach to me.
Let me take that paragraph in detail. There's no specific fact supporting that conclusion, right? And the reason is there's no actual plan for what they're going to release. We are 5 years.
They had a product with the C2I functionality.
Sure.
They say we would like to reincorporate it and relaunch it. That doesn't need a plan. That's like, I've got some old shoes in the closet and I plan on wearing them tomorrow.
Well,
like, you know, that's not really, I don't get this.
Yeah, sure, Your Honor. And I would say that we are 5 years on in a rapidly moving technological environment. The fact that they wish to reintroduce some C2I functionality does not mean they are going to pull the code off the shelf and re-implement it exactly as it was 5 years ago. Or it might. The point is they haven't told you what they're going to do, and they haven't told you how it implicates the claims. And
You think they need to tell me from a technological, you don't think it's enough that they say we want to reintroduce the C2I technology that we previously had on the product, and but we can't because of this potential threat of infringement. I mean, you're fighting me on an issue that I don't think you can probably win on, but you can keep going on that issue. But I feel like you're sort of missing the boat, because the bigger concern isn't the C2I functionality, it's the declaration's failure to link it to the new claim limitations.
But
so if you'd like to jump ship, because let me tell you, it's sinking. So if you want to jump ship, there's a life raft over here. I'm kind of floating it right out there for you.
I understand, Your Honor, and that's where I was going, is that there's no connection.
You're going by swimming in the wrong direction, my friend.
fair enough. I'm not abandoning that, like, that's not a
a specific plan where there were concrete steps that they had proven. It's a mere desire to reintroduce something. But there is no connection to the claims that this court was asked to adjudicate, and that's the failure. And that's the failure.
Why don't you address paragraph 29 of the London Declaration, sure. which is what they brought up?
Sure. It says at most that the fact that the substitute claims have been deemed patentable prevents us from reintroducing the C2I features despite a desire to do so. That there's no fact on which the court can say, yes, the substitute claims impose some sort of a blockage or dispute about whether C2I meets the new limitations. That was available to them to say if it was part of their product and part of their plan, and they did not. And that is the key point that led to the court's decisions in Platinum Optics and Insight. The rulings in those cases say you need to explain how the concrete plan actually implicates the claims in a way that makes this an actual controversy. Again, here, they have a desire to do something, and conceding Judge Moore's point that there's something on the shelf that's 5 years old that maybe they could do, we don't know whether that has eligibility check. We don't know whether that has the querying limitation. We don't even know if that's a background install product because those facts are not.
Look at what it does say. It does directly link the 256 patent, and it says that the substitute claims of the 256 patent have been deemed patentable by the P. Prevent IronSource from reintroducing the C21 features despite a desire to do so. Customers will continue to have the same view. He's talking about as they had of the other patents.
I grant you that he says that. My point is only the court has required more, which is you need to explain how. There needs to be some factual basis on which the court can agree that there is an impediment to that product, that actual product with a specific plan that implicates the claims at issue. Otherwise, there's no controversy. The fact that he offers that conclusion does not give the court any basis to scrutinize here whether it has actual jurisdiction or not. It's a statement in the air.
Ultimately, thank goodness for life rafts.
Indeed. That is the most obvious point that can be made here, right? It is shot through all of the court's recent decisions in standing from PGR and IPR appeals, that there has to be something tying to the claims, and there is not here. I'll turn to the substantive issues if the court would like to hear on those, and I'll address them as my colleague did. So, with respect to the querying limitation, again, for all these issues, we're on a substantial evidence standard, and thus the question is only whether the board had substantial evidence to find the facts that it did. With respect to the querying limitation, the board said this is a near verbatim copying of the specification into the claim, which it is. The support in the specification says that the installation client obtains address information, e.g. a link to the installation file by one of, and one of the examples is querying an address repository, e.g. on an external server, over the network and receiving the address information in response to the query. Now, the argument on appeal is simply that a skilled artisan would not understand what the query was, specifically knowing that you're querying an address repository and you are receiving back address information, the skilled artisan would not know that that query is for the address information in the database. That there is not a gap there. And even if there were a gap, there is testimony in the record from Dr. Mao that a skilled artisan would understand what the query was for, and that's at Appendix 39, 40, and 41. in the context of his claim construction argument, where he's saying the address repository itself would be understood as network-connected storage that provides a network address of an installation file in response to the query for a network address of such installation file.
Why don't you address eligibility?
Happily.
That's such an issue these days.
Understood, Your Honor. And with respect to 101, I think, again, here, the easy way to resolve this case is at step two, based on the factual determinations made by the board. There is, we think these claims are dead on for the DDR case in that they are not directed towards installation abstractly or background installation abstractly, but these new substitute claims have a specific implementation. And that's using an installation client pre-installed on the device that performs an eligibility check of the installed application before installing a new application and querying the address repository to find the application data that you wish to install. But even if this court disagrees, there's at least a question about whether those limitations are conventional, because the specification does not say that the eligibility check is conventional, because it isn't. A token-based eligibility check to check the eligibility of the application already installed on the device was new and unconventional. And thus the board was entitled to...
But isn't all that written in by software?
Your Honor, these are all software functions. That's correct. And we're describing an architecture of software and that has different types of functions. That's where the specificity comes in. There are many ways you could have a background install. But this claim is a particular way that you do a background install, where the installation client is invoked in a certain way and performs this check and queries an address. And I would say, finally, with respect to 101, I don't think they even raised a factual issue. If you look at the citations in reply at 27, they sort of bulk cited to their expert's testimony about all sorts of subjects in the PGR. But if you bear down on those to the step two testimony, they have a bare conclusion that an eligibility check is conventional. It's just an unsupported statement by their expert with no supporting facts offered. They have also cited Appendix 2579 through 80, which is testimony about disclosure by PASHA. Now, we, of course, submit that there was no disclosure by PASHA because PASHA discusses user permissions for the application you're installing. But even if there was, under this court's precedent, mere disclosure by a single reference is not proof of conventionality. Conventionality requires more than mere disclosure. It requires that a technology actually be known and conventional out in the world through multiple systems or references. With that, thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
So I would like to address counsel's continued reliance on the Platinum Optics case with respect to standing and respectfully suggest that the better case that this court should be looking at is the GE versus Raytheon case. In Platinum Optics, there was a dismissal of a patent with prejudice. That patent could not be sued again. The future products were completely conceptualized. They did not put a product on back shelf. And in the GE case, we have a specific allegation that the substitute claims are causing the injury. In fact, that is more than sufficient under GE. And in fact, in the GE case, there was absolutely no threat from Raytheon in the record. It was GE's perception that caused them to have an injury in fact. On the 101 issue, the board, like I said, started talking about, had made an error in finding that there was no abstract concept. And then in trying to say that the abstract that there was an inventive step, or in part two, that there was something that saved it. They said that the claim invention invokes the installation client to install the app in the background without interrupting the user interaction in the foreground. That's on app Appendix 56. They're basically restating the abstract concept as the inventive idea. And with respect to the changing of the ordering that the board also relied on, kind of looking at Bascom, the order that they cite, which is invoking the installation client and using that if it's available, otherwise going to the App Store, that is clearly disclosed in Pasha. It was an anticipatory reference that clearly has those. And then when we look at the new limitations in the substitute claims, the eligibility check was explained by Dr. Amaroff as being conventional, the use of tokens, conventional.
What's your best argument that ties the London Declaration to the substitute claims?
Sure. Paragraphs 24, 29, and 30 expressly reference the substitute claims as a whole, even though we don't address the specific limitations. And GE does not require a limitation-by-limitation explanation, and oblique references to the claims are sufficient.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank both counsel. The case is taken under submission.